We were supposed to have this event a week ago. Unfortunately, it got canceled. Our feeling was mutually that the show must go on. Here we are. I'm pleased to report that there are four times more of you than there were a week ago. So take that, the Council on American Islamic Relations. I'm also pleased to note that there is a camera from Fox News up there. It will be only recording we who are on the at the podium here, not you who are in the audience. I'm happy also to report that our speaker is here. He got waylaid by the Four Seasons Hotel, but fortunately it's not too far away, so he is here. So all is in order. We normally finish at 1:30, but given all that's going on, I hope you'll forgive us for going a bit over 1:30, and exceptionally today. Gatestone, as you know, is a brand new organization that Nina started that has a daily publication, very interesting and important. She told you about us. Ask you to turn off your cell phones or make them vibrate until we're finished. Our plan is to have Mr. Spencer speak for about 15 minutes initially. Then he and I will engage in a bit of dialogue, and then it will be open to the audience. Well, this is an unusual topic. This is not your usual political discussion. This is something a bit more abstruse, and therefore I thought it might be useful for he and I, as fellow specialists, to discuss this before opening it to the audience. Robert Spencer is the author of 10 books on Islam, and he's a columnist. He's a frequent lecturer and appears regularly in the media. He is director of Jihad Watch, an internet site that is much followed. He conducts seminars for the U.S. government. He holds a master's degree in religious studies from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and has been studying Islamic theology, law, and history since 1980. The origins of this book have something to do with discussions that he had with Ibn Warraq, who I'm pleased to say is in the audience here today. If you might stand up, Ibn Warraq. I'm sorry to surprise you. The author of Why I Am Not a Muslim and many other books, including books on this general subject of Muhammad and early Islam, and also in discussions with myself. And so while it is entirely his book, it has not been a book in isolation. And it is also, I think, important for me to stress that what you're about to hear is not something that Robert Spencer came up with. He is reporting to you on a legacy of scholarship that goes back to 1880, and he has summarized it and extended it and reported on it for you. So this is something quite deep and quite important. So with no further ado, please, Robert Spencer.
Thank you very much, all of you, for coming, and thank you to Nina for hosting this event and persevering. Thank you to Daniel, and thank you to my press agents at the Council on American Islamic Relations, who always are on point. One of the main reasons, actually, why I undertook this question and wrote this book was precisely to see if it could be done, if we could still talk about this in the United States of America in 2012. Because as you probably know, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, which is 57 Muslim governments around the world, 56 states, and the Palestinian Authority, has undertaken a massive and persistent, years-long now, campaign to compel and intimidate even Western states into criminalizing discussions of Islam that they consider to be inappropriate, which includes, first and foremost, discussions of the texts and teachings of Islam that inspire terrorists and are used by terrorists to recruit other terrorists, but also the study of Islam itself when it is done in a critical way or in a way designed to illuminate some of the aspects of the religion that are problematic for non-Muslims. And so, in the West, in the United States in particular today, that combined with leftist multiculturalism and political correctness has put a straitjacket on the public discourse such that people are afraid to discuss certain subjects and afraid to explore the implications of certain quite obvious facts, such as most notably that which inspires jihad terrorism, the elements of Islam that are inciting to violence and hatred. And so one of the main reasons why I thought it was important to write this book, aside from the simple fact of the value of the question itself as a historical question, was to see if it still could be done in today's political climate, or if it would be ruled out of order, out of hand, without discussion, as something outside the bounds of acceptable discourse today, which would be yet another indication of the threats to free speech and the importance of our defending the freedom of speech as our fundamental bulwark against tyranny. In any case, some people find the question itself very odd and wonder, why on earth would anybody even ask that? It's like asking if Richard Nixon existed. Well, it's a perfectly actually legitimate question, or it will be in a few hundred years, to ask if Richard Nixon existed and to examine what the evidence may be for such a phenomenon as Richard Nixon. And when we come to Muhammad, it's the same thing, because he is, of course, one of the pivotal people in history. There was a very famous book a few years back that named him the most influential person in human history. And yet, when we look at the texts and the earliest documentation of what is supposed to be the effects of his life and the records of his life, we find very many curious absences and curious omissions. I'll tell you, you remember from your days in madrasa the standard story that Muhammad was 40 years old, he was an Arabian merchant, and in the year 610 he was praying on the mountain and the angel Gabriel appeared to him and told him to recite, and over the next 23 years gave him what became the Quran, the holy book of Islam. And armed with the Quran and the words of Muhammad, the Muslims, after his death in the year 632, began to invade the surrounding areas in the Middle East and North Africa and Persia, and conquered and Islamized huge expanses of territory, all based on his inspiration. That's the basic story. When you start looking at what really happened, we go to what the people who were conquered said that was going on at the time it was going on, and what the people who were conquering, what kind of records they left behind, not just written records, but also inscriptions on buildings and coins that they issued and things like that. We find, in the first place, a yawning absence. The first chapter of this book is called The Man Who Wasn't There, because that's the first thing we see about Muhammad. He's not there. For the first 60 years after the conquests, Muhammad is supposed to have died in 632, and certainly the conquests of the Arabians, of the surrounding areas, are a historical fact that began immediately after that. By 636, they had conquered Jerusalem. By the 640s, Egypt, and so on. Until by 732, 100 years after Muhammad is supposed to have died, they have command of a huge empire stretching from southern France, all across North Africa, all across the Middle East, all across Persia, and into India. The first 60 years of those conquests, from the early 630s until the early 690s, neither the conquered people nor the conquerors ever mention Muhammad, the Quran, or Islam. The conquered people never say, the Muslims came and conquered us. They talk a whole lot about what happened. There is a great deal of documentation. Sophronius, the Patriarch of Jerusalem, who is supposed to have given over the keys to the city to the Caliph Umar when it was conquered in 636, there are extant sermons and writings of Sophronius. And the picture we get of what happened is vastly different from the picture that's in the standard history books. He never mentions that the conquerors were Muslims. He never mentions that they had a holy book. He never mentions they had a prophet. He never mentions they had a new religion at all. And neither does anybody else for 60 years after these conquests go on. So you have to understand the magnitude of this. This is as if And I'm not making a direct one-on-one comparison between the Arab conquerors and the Nazis, but this is imagine this, that the Nazis conquer all of Europe between 1939 and 1942. They roll over France, they roll over Poland, they're within miles of Moscow, the whole deal. And yet, nobody ever mentions Hitler, or National Socialism, or anti-Semitism, or any of the hallmarks of, or the swastika, or anything. It's that big of a gap. Now, how are we to explain this? Would it really be possible that conquerors who were armed, who were energized, who were inspired by the teachings of this man and this book, actually would make no mention of their foremost inspiration, and that neither they nor the people they conquered would ever take any note of what was supposed to be the central reason why they were conquering in the first place? It strains credulity. And this has led many scholars, as Dr. Pipes said, over the last century or been longer, to try to look at the available data and to try to come up with some kind of an alternative explanation. There are many, many other curiosities about this. For one thing, in the standard story of the Quran and its development, the Quran is supposed to have been delivered in perfect form, piece by piece, over a period of 23 years to Muhammad. And then you have various people who have memorized various portions of it. Some parts of it are written down, some parts of it are in memory. And the Caliph Uthman, who was the third successor of Muhammad, the leader of the Muslims, he is supposed to have gathered together all the people who had memorized parts of the Quran, and they all compared their notes, and they standardized the text of the Quran, collected it all together, and Uthman, and this is the year 653, he is supposed to have made a standard edition of the Quran from the records of all these people, and distributed it to all the Muslim lands, and burned all the variants, because they were all erroneous, after they had reached a consensus as to the text. Now, that's all fine, but then, here again, we come up against this yawning silence. Nobody in the 650s ever mentions the Quran. The Muslims don't, that is, the Arabs. The people who are being conquered never say, the Muslims came with their Quran and said, the Quran says we should wage war against you, or something of that kind. There's nothing like that there. There's no Quran. There's no Muslims. The people who are conquered, they call them the Tayyeye, or the Saracens, or the Ishmaelites, or the Hagarenes. They never call them the Muslims. Now, what is this book then? There's another very curious thing, in that one of the later leaders of the Muslims, who lived 40 years after Uthman is supposed to have collected the Quran and distributed it, there are stories about how he, or his assistant, collected the Quran and distributed it. Now, why would there be stories arising about this thing happening, this collection of the Quran happening 40 years after it was supposed to have happened and all been done? Now, there are two ways we can understand that. We can understand that it actually happened in the 650s, and the stories about it happening in the 690s are just some sort of strange error that really has no explanation. Or it makes much more sense if we postulate that in the 690s it actually happened. But then, to lend authenticity and to lend an air of authority to the product that was being manufactured in the 690s, it was retrojected back into history, and the story was invented that it had actually been done 40 years before. Now, why then, the final question, before I wrap up the opening remarks, is why on earth would this have been done? What was the point? Why invent Muhammad? If he did not exist, why was it necessary to invent him? Every empire in those days was unified not by nationality, not by political philosophy, but by religion. The two great superpowers of that age were the Eastern Roman Byzantine Empire and the Persian Empire. The Persians were Zoroastrians. The Persians were the masters of a multinational empire, but it was bound together by Zoroastrianism. The Christians, the same way. The Byzantines were the masters of a multinational empire that was bound together by Christianity. the Persians and the Byzantines in the years that correspond to the time that Muhammad is supposed to have been living and working were busy fighting against each other and wearing each other out. Whereupon, there were vast expanses of territory that neither one of them could govern properly because they were simply exhausted and their resources were depleted. There were, however, the Arabs in Arabia who were untouched by all this constant warfare and were able to take advantage of the gap that the Byzantines and the Persians had left. And they began to move into those territories and to expand rapidly and soon to consolidate a very vast empire. But then, according to the political philosophy of the day, what is it that unifies an empire? It's a religion. And that's what they didn't have. It appears from the earliest records that the pre-Islamic Arabians were either polytheists, some of them were polytheists, and some of them were the adherents of a vague monotheistic creed that had some allegiance to Abraham, the Jewish patriarch, but was not quite Judaism and was not quite Christianity and was not really very well defined at all. And from that basis, it appears from a number of evidences that are outlined in the book that some of the early, what we call them now, Muslim leaders, they actually constructed from available materials a foundation that became the Islamic religion. And they did it in order to unify and strengthen their empire. And this is one of the reasons I think that Islam itself is so martial, militaristic, and it is such a hermetically sealed, perfect warrior system that you have a win-win situation for the warriors. If they fight in the battle and they die, they go to paradise and enjoy the virgins, which is great. If they don't, if they win, then they are entitled to, by law, the spoils of war, the possessions, including the wives, of the people that they have killed. And so they either can amass wealth on this earth and enjoy everything that this life has to offer, or they enjoy it in the next world. It's a win-win situation, and it did create a foolproof warrior creed that made this empire so great and so powerful. It's also a hermetically sealed system. You can't leave Islam. You can go into Islam, but if you leave, you get killed, and so on. You start to look at it in this way. You see, everything is oriented toward creating and protecting and expanding a militant state. And that appears to be what happened. That the religion was constructed in order to justify, buttress, support, and help expand a political entity. This is the only thing, as far as I can see, from the available data, that makes sense of everything that we do know. The canonical story of the origins of Islam founders on these yawning silences, and on many, many other aspects that there's no time to get into. But notably, there are, very briefly, the Quran itself, which is supposed to be an Arabic book, has very many Arabic, non-Arabic elements, and elements that actually don't make any sense at all until you start reading them into the actual most common language of the time, which is Aramaic, and start seeing some very telling elements that indicate that it was very probably, in whole or part, a Christian text that was reinterpreted and recast. And so it appears that these imperial leaders, they took existing materials, they adapted them for their own purposes, and they created what became one of the most formidable and powerful political and religious systems that the planet has ever known. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Robert. Answer the question, did Muhammad exist?
Muhammad, as the prophet of Islam, whose biography I sketched out from the earliest Islamic texts in an earlier book, The Truth About Muhammad, that man did not exist. There is no indication that he did. Everything that we know about him, what I undertook to do in that book, was to take the earliest Muslim sources available and to just simply set out what picture they painted of Muhammad. And he's the warrior, of course, and the everything else that we know, the polygamist and I can sketch out his biography for hours, but the point here is this, that all the sources that all that is based on are, the earliest of them are from 125 years after Muhammad died. So imagine if the first biography of somebody like Ulysses S. Grant appeared now in an oral culture where there were not written records previous to that. What's more, one of the things that we know about the environment in which the earliest stories of Muhammad came into being is that they were created by, and this is by the admission of Muslim scholars themselves, they were created by warring factions within the Muslim community. There were groups that were vying for position among the Muslims, vying for influence and vying to be the leaders of the Muslim community. And they were at odds with one another. And so one of the ways that they began to support their positions was to say, well, Muhammad the Prophet, he said this and he did this. And then the other group would make up something where Muhammad the Prophet says something that's completely opposite and contradictory. You find that as a total mess in the canonical hadith today. The hadith are the reports of Muhammad's words and deeds. And the ones that are considered reliable by Muslims are normative for Islamic law. And yet, they're a complete mess. They're massive contradictions. You find that Islamic apologists who talk about Islam as peace, they will often quote a hadith in which Muhammad says, when you go to war, do not harm the women and the children. And they say, see, Islam is against killing civilians. But there's another hadith, and it's right next to it on the page in the collection of Bukhari, the most reliable collection of hadith according to Muslim scholars. It says that they were bombarding a city and they killed the women and children, and they went and asked Muhammad about it, and he said, they are of them, which means, in other words, the women and children are connected to the people who are fighting against us. It doesn't matter if you kill them. So it's completely contradictory. There is no sense to be made of it, and there is no historical core that can be found in it, because it is all so late, and it is all clearly constructed by people with motivations other than historical accuracy. Now, was there a Muhammad? Yes, it appears that there may have been. Muhammad may have been a title, meaning the praised one. There are some coins that the early Arab conquerors minted in their new domains that say Muhammad. And so you would think, well, there he is. They're talking about Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. That's what most people assume. But you flip over the coin on the other side, and it's got an image of a ruler. In the first place, images are no good in Islam. And if we are supposed to have had the Quran and had the stories that made up the Hadith at this time, then it isn't as if they found out that images were no good later. They ought to have known already. There's an image of a ruler, and he's carrying a staff with a cross on it. Islam doesn't like the cross. In Islam, Jesus is a Muslim prophet who's going to come back at the end of the world and break all the crosses. And so, do you have a ruler carrying a cross? And then on the other side it says Muhammad. It doesn't seem to be the Muhammad of Islam. It's some other guy. It's the praised one, whether that is a title of Jesus himself, and there appears to be some indications that it was, or a title given to some ruler. There may have been a Muhammad. There may have been a Muhammad who was a warrior, and even a warrior prophet. But when I say that, we have to keep very careful reserve on the fact that the earliest indications of any mention of a Muhammad or any mention of an Arabian prophet sketch out a portrait of an individual, in every case, who is nothing like Muhammad of Islam. There's one of the earliest stories about the Arabian prophet, unnamed, that a story that appears to date as early as the 640s, 10 years after Muhammad died. It says, what do you know about the prophet who's arisen among the Saracens? Well, he's preaching the coming Messiah. Well, Muhammad didn't preach the coming Messiah. That's not something that's in Islam. And it also says that he banded together with the Jews and invaded the Holy Land, which is pure fantasy. It never happened. So, there may have been a Muhammad like there may have been a Robin Hood or a King Arthur. There was not a Robin Hood like with Friar Tuck and his merry men and robbing from the rich and giving to the poor. That's all nice stories. There may have been a Robin Hood who became covered over with these legends. There may have been a Muhammad, but we can know absolutely nothing about him. And everything we do know about him is as legendary and has as much historical value as Friar Tuck and the Merry Men.
Let me go a little further into that. Robert referred to Ulysses Grant. I'd go back further and suggest that it would be like having discussion today about the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. And there's a major debate. Does this apply to individuals or to militias? And if we were to use the analogy of what happened in early Islam, I would be saying that it applies only to militias. And I heard this from so-and-so who heard it from so-and-so who heard it from so-and-so, no written records. Who heard it from George Washington, who said, and he would reply, no, I heard it from so-and-so, heard from so-and-so, that Thomas Jefferson said, and would argue that. So in other words, we're putting in the mouths of our ancestors what we ourselves are debating today. And that's what happened with the hadith, with the reports on Muhammad's life and statements. And so they grew up to be these hundreds of thousands of alleged facts about Muhammad, which have then been culled and turned into a biography. So, for example, in the 1950s, an eminent British historian by the name of Montgomery Watt wrote a two-volume history in English, about some 800 pages in total, about the life of Muhammad. And you'll find endless detail about Muhammad. But this revisionist understanding sees it as sacred history, myth, not reality. And if you put aside what are called the Arabic literary sources, put aside all these documents from 100, 200, 300, and indeed in some cases 400, 500 years later, with original information, put all that aside and go to the coins, the inscriptions, the papyri, and the sources in other languages than in Arabic, things that actually date contemporaneous from the time of early Islam, you find, as Robert said, a completely different story. And it is this scholarly effort that's been going on since a seminal article came out in 1880 that has been obscure. I doubt many of you know about it. And that Ibn Barak has made efforts to get to the general public, and now Robert has made. And it has deep significance for Islam. It is comparable to it is a spin-off. 1880 was the original article. It was a spin-off of what was called the higher criticism. The scholarly inquiry, particularly to Judaism and Christianity, the 1860s, 70s, that had deep impact on Judaism and Christianity. And as a by-the-by, a few scholars, mainly German-speaking, wrote about Islam as well. And it grew. And it grew, and it grew, and here we are today. Next question. What does this mean?
Well, I think in the first place, it's simply a question that is worth asking, just like the quest for the historical Jesus or all the historical investigations that have been done by historical critics of Judaism and Christianity for the last several centuries. Islam has been uniquely exempt from that kind of historical examination. And even in the universities all around the country, where they have no hesitation in applying the most strict and careful and exacting historical scrutiny to Judaism and Christianity, they take the canonical story of Islam at face value and retail it as if Muhammad were, as the great French historian Ernest Renan said in the 19th century, that Muhammad lived in the full light of history. That light was very dim to start with and was switched on much later. But aside from that, I think that one of the major implications of this has to do with many of the controversies that we are seeing in the United States today regarding political Islam. And the fact that under the guise of the freedom of religion, we see Muslims trying to spread in the United States ideas that are inimical to our understanding of human rights, and in many cases to basic foundational constitutional principles. And so we've seen anti-Sharia laws been passed, notably in Oklahoma in November 2010, and several others in other states, and then been struck down and successfully resisted by the Council on American Islamic Relations and other groups like it on the grounds that it infringed upon religious freedom. Now, really, nobody wants to restrict Muslims' religious freedom. I certainly don't. I don't care, as Thomas Jefferson said, as we all know, because I heard it from so-and-so who heard it from so-and-so. And he said that I don't care if my neighbor has one God or 17. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. And I don't care if my neighbor wants to read Quran and pray to Allah. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg unless he thinks that the Quran and Allah are telling him to pick my pocket and break my leg. And that's where it becomes a matter of concern to me. And so in other words, none of us here would have any concern about Islam any more than we have concern for Confucianism or Buddhism or whatever, unless we're Confucians or Buddhists, were it not for the fact that it infringes upon us, impinges upon us. And so we have to make a distinction between the political and the religious within Islam and understand that there is a political agenda that is supremacist, is authoritarian, and is contrary to constitutional principles in many ways. If we were to understand, if there were to become a general understanding, and I think this is a quixotic hope, but I will express it nonetheless, if there were to be a general understanding dawning in the public sphere that there is a political aspect to Islam, then I think that we could lawfully restrict it on the basis of protecting the Constitution as it stands and not infringing upon the religious freedom of Muslims any more than outlawing polygamy was considered to be infringing upon the religious freedom of Mormons. But the idea that Islam has a political aspect that is different from the political aspect that resides in Judaism or Christianity or any other religion, that is so dimly understood today. It makes that impossible. And so I think that one of the things that I discovered in this, didn't know that I was going to find that out coming in, but in finding that it seemed that Islam itself seemed to be the creation of a political entity in order to further political ends, if that were to become something that were widely discussed, I think it would have a great could do a great deal of good for our defense against Islamic supremacism in the United States today.
And how do you answer the question, this is a provocation, why did you do it?
I don't think that truth or the search for the truth can possibly be a provocation to any honest individual. And so people say that this is an expression of hate. And I would wonder, you know, it's very interesting that there's a New Testament scholar named Bart Ehrman who has written a book, came out a month ago, called Did Jesus Exist? And the funny thing is that nobody is calling him a bigot or a racist or a hate monger. He's just a historian. And that doesn't seem to bother Christians that historians are examining those kinds of questions. And so what I would wonder is, why is it different in this case? I dedicated this book to those who do not fear to go wherever the truth may lead them. And I think that those who do not fear to go wherever the truth may lead them are simply standing on reality and looking for its parameters. And there is no provocation in that. The people who find it provoking or provocative are those who have something who feel as if that they are under threat and have something to protect. And if they are threatened by the truth and threatened by reality, then that's a very unfortunate situation for them to be in.
Let's open it up to the audience. Yes, Michael.
What do you think the likely response of the professional...
What do you think the likely response from professional apologists like Karen Armstrong would be to your book?
I expect that the response will be scorn, derision, ridicule, and absolutely no engagement with the points that I raise in the book. That's generally the MO of people like Karen Armstrong, John Esposito, Carl Ernst. I could go on, but you get the idea. I have generally found that there is among the most respected names in this field a remarkable unwillingness to engage with dissenting views or to be willing to defend their own. They are rather rulers by fiat who demand that we accept their word on the basis of their authority, and they are not to be questioned. And so, you know, Karen Armstrong, she reviewed my book, The Truth About Muhammad, a few years back in the Financial Times, and she wrote plain falsehoods. She said, Spencer never discusses this. And so I wrote, the Financial Times was kind enough to print a letter from me saying, well, actually, that's on page 57, and so on. And the point was that I asked her, invited her to a debate or to a discussion, because we had biographies of Muhammad that came out. She's written two, actually, and her second one came out around the same time as mine. And so I asked her to have a discussion. After all, she's engaging with me enough to review the book, but there was no debate. And there never has been, and I doubt there ever will be. These people will not defend their views because I think they know they cannot.
What about the scholars who do engage in this inquiry? Indeed, a couple of them review your text.
Well, I did have some of the scholars who are working in this field review the text. And some of them asked not to be named, and so I will respect that. But I can tell you that some of the sources that I used in the book, who are historians who have made very, very close and extensive studies of some of the questions in this book. Actually, Ibn Warraq also reviewed the text. And he is one of the foremost authorities as the editor of a very important collection, The Quest for the Historical Muhammad, as well as another one, The Origins of the Quran. And so this book has been vetted by some of the leading authorities internationally in this field, and has been given a clean bill of health. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, thank you so much. If you're reviewing any religion, there seems to be parts of that history that nobody really wants to talk about, and certainly in the Old Testament, there are plenty of chapters that we never read in Sunday school when we were growing up. They had to kill everybody and kill the children. And I think the question is, where are the values today? And that's why what you're doing is so important, if in fact it can lead to an actual discussion of values and what values do we want religion to hold for us today. And that's what's so problematic, I think, in the discussion of where's the leadership of Islam, and where is the discussion in America, and is it in fact, I mean, Paul Berman recently wrote an article in the Republic about the Farquhars, and there's simply aspects of which are not open for discussion at all. And I think if you could utilize this to lead to that sort of discussion about what values do we really want.
What values do we want to uphold?
What do we want a debate or a discussion to lead to, whether Islamists are going to be participate or not? Where can that discussion lead?
Yeah, you know, I'll tell you something. Last night I was on a panel at Temple University in Philadelphia, and the whole place was packed with hostile students who ultimately, most of them, about 10 minutes in, started chanting and got up en masse and left. And that was fine, because then the rest of us could carry on a reasonably civil discussion. But I'll tell you what happened. I was the first speaker, and I got up, and it was a conference, it was called the Islamic Apartheid Conference, and it was supposed to shed light on the oppression of women and religious minorities and others in Islam. And so I started out by noting that the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights in Islam, which was formulated by the leading Muslim countries in the world as a response to the UN's Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that the Cairo Declaration of Human Rights submits all rights to Islamic law, and that Islamic law, in its traditional formulations, all across the Madhhab, the schools of jurisprudence, they all teach that a Jew's life and a Christian's life and a Hindu's life and any non-Muslim's life is actually worth less than a Muslim's. This is a standard element of Islamic law. In Islamic law, you have blood money. If you kill someone, you don't necessarily have to go to prison. You can, if the family of the deceased, if the family of the person you killed agrees, then you pay them a sum of money, and that settles the matter. But the amount of money is actually stipulated in Islamic law. And the lives of Jews and Christians and other non-Muslims are actually valued less in Islamic law. So I explained that. And I explained that this was not just one law book or one man's opinion, but this was all across the schools of jurisprudence, Sunnis and Shiites. I quoted a Shiite authority, Sultan Hussein Tabande, who wrote a critique of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in Iran in 1970, and explained then that there was the death penalty for apostasy, because Muhammad or Islamic tradition is said, if anybody changes his religion, kill him. And the death penalty for apostasy is also a universal in Islamic law. And so that we were standing here, standing as advocates for the equal dignity of all human persons, and the freedom of conscience, and the equality of rights of women with men, and the equality of rights of non-Muslims with Muslims, and so on. And you all, I addressed the hostile chanting crowd, are here because you think that we are the enemies of freedom and human rights, but which one of us is here standing and calling for equality and freedom? It's us, not you. You are here running interference for and defending the people who are against these fundamental rights. And so, I mean, I hope, I'm not sure that I'm addressing the question that you asked, but I'm hoping that I am, that these are the values we are contending for. And it's being obscured today as to what we are all about because of the propaganda that is part of the tremendous propaganda machine that that Islamic tradition has, that even the creation of Muhammad and the Quran are part of.
Richard Rubenstein.
Having spent my professional career as a historian of religion, one of the things that I've asked myself over and over again is, why is it that Jewish and Christian scholars largely deal with religious texts, even the Bible, and come to comparable conclusions on historical matters? And, of course, there's the issue of archaeology as well. But this has been absolutely absent from any kind of Islamic discussion. And I must say, I haven't been paying attention. I'm grateful to you for what you've done, and I will certainly read this book and read it studiously.
Well, I think you're probably wise. Thank you.
Well, I have one question.
Yes.
The Organization of the Islamic Conference and many other groups try to work with the United Nations, and even our own State Department is playing this game of finding ways to outlaw blasphemy and disrespect religion. And it seems to me that would be a direct attack on any kind of scholarly, scientific study of religion in Islam, such as you've undertaken. I do want to congratulate you.
Thank you. You honor me, and I am humbled by it, because I know that you are one of the most eminent professors in this field, and it seems to me that what you're saying is very urgent and absolutely right, that we are in grave threat today from the OIC, which has renamed itself, by the way, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, but it's the same organization. The OIC, that they are trying to impose Islamic blasphemy laws upon us, and that the idea that it's impermissible to discuss these matters is an indication of how much we have acquiesced to that program already. In Islam, a non-Muslim who is a subjugated dhimmi, the protected person, so-called protection, kind of like Don Corleone would offer you, the protected person in Islamic law is forbidden to mention anything impermissible about the Quran or Islam or Muhammad on pain of death. And this is exactly the situation that we are heading toward. And it may seem fanciful to you, but think about it. There was actually a case a few years back of a terror plot at Fort Dix where some Muslims were going to go into Fort Dix and shoot as many American soldiers as possible before they were themselves killed. But they made a big mistake in planning this thing. They loved to watch gory jihad videos, beheadings, and that kind of thing. And so they had them on VHS tapes. So they wanted to transfer them to DVD. They took them to the video store, and they gave them to this kid, and they asked him to transfer them. So he's watching this horrible stuff and transferring it to DVD, and he's very disturbed by what he sees. He goes to his manager, and listen, he said, I think that I should go to the police about this, but would that be racist? Now, this is a true story, and we can be very grateful. The young man did ultimately go to the police, but the idea that he would hesitate, that he would think for a moment that it would be racist to try to forestall a jihad terror attack, just shows what a number they've done on us already. That we have internalized these Sharia rules, that it's not permissible to think about these negative thoughts about Islam and Muhammad. It must not be done. And now, you know, it's very disturbing because the OIC had a closed door, a 3-day closed door meeting with Hillary Clinton about how to implement their program to eradicate Islamophobia and to criminalize what they call defamation of religion, which means the truth about Islam. I don't know what they didn't say what Hillary said to them. This was never announced, but it's very disturbing. And the implications are very great. In the back, Nina?
I'm John Rose. First of all, I thoroughly enjoyed your comments.
Thank you.
As well. The question I have is essentially related to today, which is we can take this history and we can try to analyze it, and obviously we don't have a Spinoza in the Islamic world the way we had, who began the process of biblical criticism. But whatever criticism you have, within the Muslim world and even the Muslim world outwardly has a rage.
I'm sorry, has what?
Has a rage.
Yeah.
Rage.
Oh, yeah.
The rage is within, towards their own governments, and their rage is to the West. And okay. The question I have for you is that in the context of Islamicizing Europe and potentially trying to Islamicize the way we here in America view Muslim culture and
yes.
The Muslim religion, what are the policies that are going to have to be taken in the context of delegitimizing Israel?
Delegitimizing Israel?
Yeah, the delegitimization of Israel is partly a function of the inability to respond to the Arab world in some way.
Oh, very much so, yeah. Well, of course, obviously, if we're going to stop...
on the verge of some massive anti-Semitism.
Well, this is coming from the top. If we're going to stop the delegitimization of Israel, the first thing we have to do is vote Barack Obama out of office. So... The war against Israel is a jihad war. The Camp David, Oslo, roadmap, all of these things failed, not because the Israelis weren't willing to cut off their right arm and give it to the Palestinians. They were willing to do and make any number of concessions. But it was because of the jihadist intransigence. And so trying to bring this back to the topic at hand, I can tell you one thing, that a lot of people ask me, and this is a question that I think ought to be addressed, is why does it matter? Because Muslims will believe Muhammad existed anyway. And so it doesn't really matter whether he did or not. They think he did. And that's certainly true. And that's not going to change. But in the first place, there is a movement that we can begin to make. There is a ball we can start rolling. And one of the things that we're doing is we are getting this book translated into Arabic, and we're going to have it available as a free PDF online with the intention of distributing it as widely as possible within the Islamic world, in order to try to undermine some of these adamantine assumptions that lead to the delegitimization of Israel and the endless war against Israel, as well as many, many other conflicts around the world. One more. Yes, sir.
What were some of the more surprising or incendiary things you came across in your research that did not make their way into the book that you could share with us today?
That did not make their way in the book. Oh, I don't know. It's all pretty incendiary in there. If it was incendiary, I threw it in. Let's see. That's a tough one. I'm trying to think of what didn't make it into the book. The things that are on the cutting room floor, I don't revisit, you know? Goodness. Surprising and incendiary, but not in the book. I think I might have to pass on that. I'm sorry. I think some of the most surprising and incendiary things that are in the book, I detailed very briefly before, that you have these strange double stories. You have that 40 years after the Quran's supposed to be collected and distributed, you have stories about the Quran being collected and distributed. And you also have very telling traditions that are from around the same time. People saying, we never used to read the Quran in the mosques, and now we do, in the 690s. You know, why didn't they read the Quran in the mosques before that? Well, because it didn't exist. And you have later on some people, some Christian writers, went in the early part of the 8th century, starting to talk about the Quran and Muhammad. And you have some guys, St. John of Damascus, but some of the other Christian writers, referring to the Muslims, and they say they have this book, the Quran, and they have another book, Surah Al-Baqarah. Well, that's the chapter of the cow. That's the second chapter of the Quran. But he treats it as if it's a separate book altogether, which indicates it must not have been collected together. You never refer to chapter 3 of the book you're reading as a separate book unless it's in a different cover. And so there's so many strange curiosities about that I hadn't known until I started investigating these things that make it clear the story doesn't add up.
Why don't you say a quick word about Laylat al-Qadr, the Night of Power?
Oh, yeah. That's a great one. Thank you. The Night of Power is the night on which Muhammad is supposed to have had his first visitation from the angel Gabriel. And it's also the 108th surah, the 108th chapter of the Quran, is the Night of Power. And it says, would that you knew what the Night of Power is. It's a very brief surah. And it says, it's the night and the vigil and the angel and the star. Now, does this start to ring a bell? A night, angel, star, vigil. Not only does it sound very Christmassy to start with, but you start to look at the Aramaic substratum underneath the Arabic that I mentioned very briefly before. That Arabic is a language. It's a language in which many, many of the letters are identical to other letters, except for the diacritical marks. That is, the dots that go above or beneath. And so, in other words, you have several letters that look like this, sort of a bowl shape, and you have a dot above it, it's one letter, you have a dot below it, it's a different letter, you have three dots above it, it's a third letter, and so on. So the earliest Qurans don't have those dots, which means that the text is endlessly variable. It could say any number of things. It doesn't have to say what the Muslims are saying it says at all. You start looking at that and you start reading it in Aramaic instead of in Arabic, and you find actual Christian liturgical terms that refer to the Christmas vigil that Christians celebrate the night before Christmas, and actually specific terms that are used for the angels and the star and the whole thing. And it's clear that you have an account of Christmas vestigially in the Quran, as well as an account of the Eucharist, the Christians consuming the body and blood of Christ, and he said that this bread is my body at the Last Supper, and so on. And that's in the Quran. But it's completely obscured by these layerings over that shift the meanings of several of the important words. And only when you strip that away do you see what's really going on.
In conclusion, before we end, you mentioned translation of the book into Arabic. What is your hope of the impact of this book on Muslims?
Well, I would hope that the impact of the translation into Arabic of this book would be nothing less than the impact of the historical criticism upon Judaism and Christianity in the 19th and 20th centuries. Judaism and Christianity obviously still live and thrive, but there was, in segments of both traditions, a massive reevaluation of the entire tradition based on these new historical investigations, that in many cases involved a rejection of strict literalism. Now, I am not necessarily endorsing this enterprise in every respect in regard to Judaism and Christianity, but I think a rejection of strict literalism when it comes to Islam would be most welcome, particularly in regard to the violent passages of the Quran. And so I'm not trying to rob Muslims of their faith necessarily, but simply to try to trigger a large-scale reevaluation that might make it more possible for people who differ in conscience on fundamental questions in this world to live in peace and harmony with one another without one trying to gain hegemony over the other. Thanks very much.
Yes. So thank you so much. Thanks to Gatestone. You have copies of the book. I have read it. I endorse it. I think it's both illuminating and also very interesting. Hope you'll do the same. I think this is an important event because with it, Robert is launching this book. We don't know what its course might be. We don't know that if it'll be attacked, derided, or read, and taken seriously. We're hoping for the best. And wish you very well in this.
Thank you very much.
In this, and thank you very much to Nina, to Robert, and to all of you for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you all so much from the Gatestone half of the teamwork here.